Is your appetite sometimes out of control? Are you unable to stop eating even when you're full? Download our new Intelligent Medicine video, Defensive Eating, Taming Your Addiction to Food. There's a physiological basis for food addiction. The food industry has gripped our brains using powerful food science. Find out what we can do about it. Go to drhoffman.com to download this important video. We will arm you with proven strategies to change your eating behavior forever. Go to drhoffman.com. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and it is once again time for our weekly Q&A with Layla. And that involves the email that you send us with your questions to radioprogram@AOL.com, AOL.com. And each week we answer your questions. I do it in tandem with our Hoffman Center nutritionist, Layla Mutin, who's here with us today. Layla is a registered dietitian. She also holds a master's degree in the field of nutrition. And Layla, you know, something cool happened to me this morning. I was, I just come from the gym and I was like all sweaty and I went to the outdoor market and I had my headphones on, so I was kind of oblivious to what was happening. And there was this woman like, you know, came up to me and she started gesturing at me, but I had my headphones on with, you know, playing like whatever, AC/DC or something. And, you know, and so when people do that, it's a little disorienting. You know, the other day somebody came up to me just like that, and I, you know, went up to him.
Yeah.
And it turned out to be a panhandler.
Oh.
You know, and he acted like he was my best friend, you know, like, hey, how are you? But anyway, so this was, so I took off my earbud, and the woman told me, oh, Dr. Hoffman. And I said, yes. And she said, I want to thank you for those wonderful podcasts that you do. You know, she was an active, healthy senior. So it's gratifying to know that there are people out there, and you know, and I'm enough of a minor celebrity. You know, people don't hear my voice more than see my face. I'm not on TV that much to be recognized, and it was nice to get acknowledged for doing that.
Website, so, you know,
website,
everybody's
yeah.
going on the internet. There yeah. are pictures yeah. there and everything, yeah. and that's wonderful.
Yeah, but you know, I'm not dressed in my sweaty workout clothes usually. So
that's okay. She could see that you walk the talk.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's going better than she should see me, you know, in a McDonald's.
Right.
You know.
Right. Exactly.
Or walking around with a cigarette dangling from my lip. You know.
Right. Oh my goodness.
So what's in the news this week? You know, we talked a little bit. I talked to you a little bit about an article which created a bit of a splash because it was a headline: low fat diet beats low carb diet in terms of weight loss.
Yeah.
And it made the headlines. It was like, well, wait a minute, we're getting whipsawed here, because first it was like, okay, don't eat fat. And lately it's been don't eat carbs. So everybody nowadays, people are saying, oh, I'm watching my carbs. You know, it's the influence of Atkins, whom you worked for, and subsequently everybody's on the bandwagon with that. And we have been for quite some time. We've been consistent about that.
Yes.
And now comes along another study, which is, you idiots, you've been following the wrong advice. It turns out that it's a low-fat diet which is best for weight loss.
They lost more fat is what they showed, yes.
Right.
On a low-fat diet, you can lose more fat.
Right. So take it away. You spent a little time looking at
the study, exactly.
It.
And I'll be writing about that in a future newsletter, not next week. I have something else lined up, but in a future one. Unfortunately, and here's the bottom line, the low-carb diet they tested indeed was not low-carb. It was 140 grams of carbs per day that these people were taking on having on their diet. That's in no way, shape, or form a low-carb diet.
But it seems the study design is sometimes a way to prove your point. So if you set up a study to fail, you can prove your point. And
absolutely.
It turns out the low fat diet was a very rigorous diet. It was like less than 7%
fat. It was like an Ornish diet, less than 7%
So, yeah, you're going to lose weight on that. And then they compared it to a not-so-good low-carb diet, and, of course, the low-fat...
You can't even call it a low-carb diet.
Right.
You could just call it a moderate-carb diet.
Also, a problem that I noted, and I actually shared it with my radio listeners last week on the show, is that the study was an extrapolation. It was done for a very short time. like for a couple of weeks.
About,
I think.
Yes, exactly. There was a washout period, and then
so they don't know how these people would have done long term. It wasn't a real life study, but what they did is they did some computer simulation.
Yes,
to say if at the rate that they seem to be going, mm-hmm. in a year they would have lost more weight with the low fat diet than the low carb diet. But that's in a simulation.
And exactly, and our metabolism is not static.
Yes,
we don't know how the metabolism will function after 2 months, 6 months,
right.
a year on a low-fat diet or even a low-carb diet. There will be shifts.
Right.
So you really can't make a statement like
now,
that.
Now, also, there was a little something about this guy's orientation to begin with. I believe this guy is a vegan advocate.
Oh,
to begin
really?
With. Yeah. Is that, you know, I checked a little background on the person.
Okay.
And so, you know, he's coming at this with a little bit of a bias. Rather than this being pure science, it sounds like...
Let's set up a study so that I get the result that I'm looking
right,
for.
Right,
mm. Unfortunately, a lot of scientists are that way. They're married to a conclusion, and they're looking for the right test to get that conclusion.
Right, and
it's
we
bias.
See this all the time when we are trying to demonstrate the efficacy of the latest, greatest new drug. They're always exaggerating the benefits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And an interesting thing happened recently is that they've actually required that all peer-reviewed studies be published in their entirety on the Internet. You know, it's like a full disclosure thing.
Huh.
And the net result of that is since they've ordered this...
Mm-hmm.
Less positive studies are being published.
Oh, wow.
You know, so what that means is that there has been self-censorship and that the people who put out the studies have deep six studies which don't actually come up
with the results
conclusions
they
that they want to demonstrate. So the shining a light on studies has resulted in less studies coming to the fore, because you know they're afraid that the results of the studies will actually demonstrate that this or that or the other medication usually is not working.
Yeah, interesting. Well,
so anyway, so that's a little sidelight. Let's get to our questions.
Yes, we have a question from Barb about cataracts, and she actually references something from PBS NewsHour about eye drops that may clear cataracts. She says, cataract surgery is a major medical industry in this country. Will this kind of research receive the consideration it deserves? What would the eye doctors do if this became a reality in another decade? And keep up the great work, Dr. Hoffman.
Well,
so,
that would suggest that we, you know, a lot of med students should stop going into ophthalmology. Because
at least for cataracts.
Right, because well, they'll be able to do other types of stuff. But
right.
That's a major source of income for ophthalmologists.
Sure.
Hey, guess what? You know, we're living longer and longer and longer. And chances are that if you live to a ripe old age of 75 or 80, you're going to have a cataract operation.
Absolutely.
And actually, I've considered that. You know, maybe that's something that eventually I would have to undergo. And it's not terrible because all the people that I talk to have had cataract surgery. They get great results. They really see well. They've really come up with good ways to do cataract surgery. And it sounds kind of icky because they operate on your eye and nobody wants that. But ultimately, they'll replace your lens with these really wonderful prescription lenses so you don't have to wear glasses anymore.
My mother is 78 years old, and she just had her second eye, the cataract surgery, and now she has bionic vision. She gets to throw away her glasses to watch television with, and it's great. It's given her a lot more confidence and everything. But yeah, it was really no big deal. I took her to the second surgery. My sister took her to the first one. It's really no big deal. The care was excellent, and now she's got bright, shiny, bionic vision.
Well, let's talk about these drops. What's the story on these new drops? Now, by the way, when I hear of eye drops that help cataracts, I think of something called carnosine eye drops.
Yes.
Which is this a natural thing that's available, actually, you get in health food stores. And my take on that is that the evidence for that is not that strong. I haven't really seen good clinicals that show
rigorous.
That people who see better with that, and theoretically it's nice because we know that carnosine unlike carnitine, it sounds like carnitine, but carnosine is something that seems to have an anti-aging effect, as in ages advanced glycation end products. It seems to inhibit the formation of ages, which may be part of the process by which the lens blurs and opacifies. It gets fried, literally, by the biochemical processes that are associated with skin wrinkling and organ damage, and carnosine has this effect against that. But whether or not putting carnosine eye drops in your eyes once you have cataracts will melt the cataracts away, I don't know if that's the case. So this is something else, though.
This is something else. And this this was a study
and
done.
It would be a prescription. It wouldn't be like a health
It would be a prescription.
Right.
And this is not anywhere near ready for prime time. There was a study released that shows that a natural chemical produced in our bodies called linosterol prevented the clumping of proteins in a petri dish.
Like a phytosterol.
It sounds like a phytosterol, exactly. Right. And it's naturally made, and they find that in a petri dish, the protein aggregates in cataract would dissipate. So because the researchers were very buoyed by this result, they took some dogs with cataracts, and they gave them this linosterol over the course of 6 weeks.
And then, the dogs reported that they had much better vision.
Exactly.
Think about what I just said.
Yeah.
The dogs did not report.
Right. Exactly. So the researchers actually saw an increase in the lens transparency and also decreased cloudiness of the cataract.
That's objective. Objective. So maybe there is something to this.
Maybe.
But there's a reservation about this.
There is a reservation. They are skeptical. It's difficult to determine conclusively if it was the linosterol or any effect of any reagent. And we need to see human trials before we decide that this is something
about hard cataracts. Once they reach a certain type, a certain stage, and apparently there are different types of cataracts.
Yeah.
I think diabetics have different cataracts than ordinary people, for example. So
that may be due to more ages, and I wonder if it just hardens their lens even more.
Yeah.
If that's what's going on there.
Well, sorbitol seems to be a factor in diabetic cataracts.
Mm.
Let's talk just briefly about, is there anything that can be done naturally to slow the progression of cataracts? And the answer is
vitamin C.
You don't smoke. Wear great sunglasses, right? Don't look in the sun.
I've heard a contrary thing about sunglasses, that because it allows our pupil to dilate, maybe we're getting
I see what you're saying, is that it gives you almost like a false sense of security.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
That's interesting. So, just like there's been some contrarians about, we actually did a show on this, about the dangers of sunscreen because it gives you a false sense of security and it allows certain harmful rays to penetrate the skin. And ordinarily, you would burn earlier, you get a warning sign that your skin is damaged. But, let's get to the things that are helpful. Antioxidants to be helpful.
I've seen some research that shows taking vitamin C throughout your life, starting at an early age, can help to keep the lens more clear. One of the antioxidants, anyway. And you have to be living a good, clean life, not just taking vitamin C and going to the bar and smoking.
I would imagine
so
there are other sources of free radical damage that are equivalent to cigarette smoke that may influence the formation of cataracts.
Yeah. So,
perhaps things like N-acetylcysteine or glutathione might be helpful.
Glutathione
eye drops, who knows?
Lutein zeaxanthin, but I wonder if that's more for macular.
That's more for the retina, but on the other hand, there are some studies that suggest that these eye formulas that we use for the retina may also somewhat slow the progression of cataracts, too.
Wow.
That's part of the ARID study. Mm-hmm. I think the ARID study also included a little bit of investigation of whether these supplements could have an impact, not just on the retina, but also on cataracts. And it seemed there was a little bit of an impact.
Wow.
So that would be lutein, zeaxanthin, zinc.
Zinc, beta-carotene, or vitamin A.
The right kind of vitamin E.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Barb, thank you very much for your question. And we'll be on the lookout for any more news on linosterol. Our next question comes from Sharon. Sharon is currently taking Enbrel for rheumatoid arthritis, which is also keeping her early signs of Crohn's disease under control.
It is, actually, these are immunosuppressive medications which are used for both rheumatoid arthritis and ulcerative colitis, is it, or
yeah,
Crohn's?
Yeah, she has Crohn's.
Oh, Crohn's
early,
disease.
Early Crohn's.
Okay. And it's not a coincidence that she's got two autoimmune diseases
yeah.
simultaneously.
Yeah.
And by the way, when a lot of inflammatory bowel patients have joint manifestations, I think about 20% of patients with ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease have joint manifestations
yeah.
because the disease is not just in the intestine, it's systemic. Mm-hmm. And gut problems sometimes mm-hmm. don't stay in the gut. They are,
yeah. Well, Sharon is writing because her GI doctor is suggesting that she take a 6-week course of Entacort.
It's a steroid.
Yeah. For elevated lactoferrin, which was detected on a stool test. She doesn't want to take any more medicine because she's right. not having symptoms.
So we see what she's talking about.
Should
is...
Should she take it?
Yeah. This is what we're talking about. Is like, okay, when I work with patients who have ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, how do we know if they're better? So one is they come back and they say, I feel great. I'm having normal bowel movements. I feel good.
Yeah.
No blood,
no mucus. No urgency,
right,
predictable
exactly.
bowel movements.
Exactly. So number one is subjectively, are you better? But could you be in a fool's paradise? And some
yeah.
people might say, who cares? You feel better. It's no problem. But actually, there is a problem because you could have silent inflammation. And mm-hmm. silent inflammation in ulcerative colitis in particular is a predictor of cancer risk. So you want to make sure that you're really curing the disease.
Yeah.
And this is one of the reasons why doctors are now more aggressive with drugs about treating ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. And this is a, you know, one of the reasons why it's sometimes hard to get my patients off of drugs as they go back to the GI, and the GI says, yeah, you're feeling better, but you still have it.
Yeah.
So how do you know that you still have it? Well, one way is to look up there and actually do a colonoscopy or a sigmoidoscopy and see, is there inflammation? Is there ulceration? Is it red? That's one
yeah.
way. But that's an inconvenient way, and you know, do it that often. So in the interim, in between colonoscopies, how do you know if you're okay? You can do a blood test. Blood test might show a high white count. It might show a high SED rate or a high C-reactive protein.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes it doesn't, and you still have a problem.
Mm.
One very discriminating way to see if you have any kind of inflammation is to do a stool test looking at lactoferrin, but also looking at other markers in the stool that determine whether you have inflammation. Eosinophilic uh-huh. protein X is another marker of inflammation.
Wow.
And if that's high, that tells me my patient is not completely cured yet.
Okay.
Or in remission. And so we have still some work to do. So, and there, you know, there are other markers, but that this is, and it's easy. I mean, you just make, you know, leave a stool sample and mm-hmm. send it in a mailer to a lab, which will analyze mm-hmm. it. It's a take-home test. So that's what she's talking about. Now, so as to her question, I don't know. I mean, I think it's a clinical judgment. You know, the doctor may be overzealous because he's treating a lab test.
Yeah.
She seems to be well.
She's already taking Enbrel for RA.
Right. The advantage of taking Entacort, it's enteric coated, so it opens up in the intestine. It doesn't cause as many systemic symptoms of the steroids,
uh-huh.
but it still does. It
okay.
still does. So, you know, I'm not going to, you know, take issue with the doctor. It could be argued that that's over aggressive, I guess.
Okay.
Is it a life and death, you know, open and closed case for using the Entacort? I don't think so. But there's no discussion here of diet, and I think she needs to be on
right.
the specific carbohydrate diet. She
at
needs
the
to
very
be taking
least,
the right supplements.
An autoimmune diet, she needs to be taking the right supplements.
And
specific carbohydrate diet, Sharon should look up the late Elaine Gottschall's book, Breaking the Vicious Cycle. And the
right.
supplements that we like
right.
you know, plenty of fish oil, the enterocoated fish oil.
Vitamin D, curcumin.
Oswalian, C-Cure.
C-Cure, which is fish peptides.
Yeah. A particular probiotic made for inflammatory bowel mm-hmm. disease, not just any old probiotic. This
right.
is very important, yeah.
So, interesting question.
Yeah. Sharon, thank you for your question. We wish you the best of luck. This question comes from Lisa. I started taking some digestive enzymes recently because I thought it might be helpful. I've lost 1.5 pounds. As you know, I already eat super cleanly. And do I know that? Do we know you, Lisa? and I'm at a good weight. But the digestive enzymes seem to allow me to eat a little more without gaining any weight. Why is that?
Well,
first of all,
okay.
a pound, 1.5 pounds in either direction only tells me about your water table.
Mm-hmm.
Not that you've lost any
right.
significant weight.
Right.
It's your hydration status.
Right.
I don't know.
Well, I have a couple of theories on
okay.
that. Okay. Let's suppose that she has lost weight mm-hmm. with the digestive enzymes. It really could go either way. Like somebody who's wasting away and has terrible maldigestion and they take digestive enzymes, they could actually gain weight because they're absorbing their nutrients better.
Yeah.
So it's a little...
Which is a good thing, yes.
Which is good.
Yeah.
But it's counterintuitive that taking digestive enzymes would make you lose weight. Now, why might that be? Well, number one, digestive enzymes might actually create a sense of satiety. There's these what are called vasoactive peptides in the digestive tract, mm-hmm. whereby there's a system of feedback. Is once you release your own digestive enzymes, it engenders a cascade of release of certain satiety hormones in your gut mm-hmm. that make you feel full. So it's possible that taking digestive enzymes are making her have earlier satiety. She feels full with less food. That's
yeah.
number one.
Yeah.
Number two, she may be altering her microbiome by changing the way that she's digesting, and that
yeah.
is associated with weight change.
Loss.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Weight loss or weight gain or, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, your initial reaction, I agree, is like, it's all big whoop, you know, mm-hmm. pound is not a trend. If it's like 8, 10, 12 pounds, you know.
That's something to
yeah.
look at, to
yeah.
investigate. So, yeah, that's interesting. Carry on, Lisa, eat cleanly, and... let us know. All right. Let us know if you lose more than that pound or pound and a half.
We may have discovered another miracle cure for
wow.
overweight.
Wow. Maybe. Our next question comes from Judy. Hi, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. My husband's high sensitivity C-reactive protein is 1.62, and his homocysteine is 13.1. If they both measure inflammation, why is one result normal and one result
they
high?
They don't. Are you sure we haven't answered this question already?
Yeah, we've got that in our newsletter.
Oh,
I actually published the answer in our newsletter.
Okay, so let's repeat the answer.
Yeah. First of all, high sensitivity C-reactive protein and homocysteine are not related. And one doesn't necessarily measure inflammation. Homocysteine is not really a measurement of inflammation per se. C-reactive protein will be. And HS, or high sensitivity C-reactive protein, is more about inflammation in our coronary arteries.
Right.
At 1.62, it's not necessarily a low number, but more of a moderate number,
it's
which is
bad.
Just fine. It's not bad at all.
The cutoff for normal is, it should be less than 2.
It should be less than 2,
But
yeah.
optimally, we'd love to see it less
Under
than 0.5.
Mm,
you know, that would be
0.5.
That's just pristine
that would be
arteries.
Something. Yeah. Now, homocysteine, on the other hand, is a glitch in protein metabolism, which requires more B vitamins for that high homocysteine to convert back to methionine. A high homocysteine, is a risk factor for things like stroke, coronary artery disease, bone fracture, as well as Alzheimer's disease, as well as regular dementia, not just Alzheimer's. So that's what homocysteine is a measurement of. The number, your husband's homocysteine at 13.1 is on the high side, Judy. We like to see it under 9 or 8,
mm-hmm.
and optimally, really.
And what can happen
under
with a high
8.
Homocysteine? What are the concerns?
Yeah, coronary artery disease, stroke. These are risk factors.
Mm-hmm.
Alzheimer's.
And dementia, actually. Yep.
Mm-hmm. So these are two separate measurements, and one is really the marker of inflammation. The way to reduce C-reactive protein is an anti-inflammatory diet, less sugar, starches, no junk food, get enough sleep, all of that, taking antioxidants.
Magnesium,
to quash inflammation in the body. Homocysteine requires methylated B vitamins, methylcobalamin, which is your B12, methylfolate, which is your source of folate, B6, betaine, trimethylglycine. These are helpful in lowering homocysteine.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be the way to go.
Yeah.
That would be the way to go.
Okay. That's great. So that concludes part one of today's edition of Q&A with Layla. And those of you who are aficionados, you know that you should turn to side B, or actually flip to, that's a reference to something called an LP, which many of you, if you're younger, you don't know what that is. But no, actually in our modern era, we're going to fast forward to part two of today's Q&A with Layla. And the opening salvo, the question will be what?
I was just diagnosed with a DVT.
All right. So what do we do? I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.